Okay, can somebody add some wind and background noise to kind of ease the transition? Thanks. Okay, I'm done. So that was, I don't know, hopefully you stayed tuned through all of it, but the long story short is we're exploring opportunities to move to a different location because it's getting harder and harder to stay here. And I don't know, as I was listening to Greg, I was kind of thinking about how in our own lives, you know, you get to these places in your lives where it's pretty mucky and messy, and you don't really know what's coming next. And we always talk about, well, what does it mean to have faith and to trust? Well, this is kind of what it means. You don't know what's coming, and we're trusting God with it. We are putting this in God's hands, and we're going to be a people who don't panic, but we think, okay, God, what do you have for us next? And I think it's, I just have a feeling it's going to kind of blow us away, what God delivers on for us. But it's going to take all of us to pull together and be a community and brainstorm and just think together and trust and have faith together. So I'm really excited about it. I want to give you guys a chance just to say hi to each other, maybe find a couple people you don't know or just visit and maybe react a little bit with each other to what you heard, you know. Oh, before I forget, too, this Monday night and Tuesday night, there's going to be the opportunity to come and meet Monday night at Turtle Bread, Tuesday night at the Riverview Cafe, just to ask questions, talk more about pretty much anything you want to talk about. Greg and a few others of us will be there, and other leaders in the community. So come and talk if you want to. It's on your paper, the times and locations. So go ahead and take a few minutes, say hi to each other, react to the video, whatever you want to do. Thanks.
The depression will be nothing compared to 1913 when it hits us. 1930, when the depression came, will be nothing like it will be in the coming years. If we lose America, we have nowhere else to run for freedom. There is no country left that promotes free markets, corporations, not in politics. There's no country that has their own sound currency. There is nowhere left to run. If we lose America, we lose the world to the elite. The 1% will continue to get rich as we all live like slaves. If you think the way of life is bad now, you will all be living in projects like Hooverville's. We cannot continue to print money.
Don't you like it when I'm... Good morning. Good morning, everybody. My name is Peter. I'm one of the pastors here. Thanks to all of you for being here and being a part of this day. A lot of stuff in that video from Greg to kind of process and think about, and it gives you a little bit of moment to kind of just pause and, you know, what's going on. And hopefully you had a little bit of conversation about that just now with the people next to you, and we encourage you to keep talking with each other. Take advantage of those opportunities on Monday and Tuesday. Seek us out. Don and I will both be available after the service if you want to come talk to us and just wonder out loud with us. That's part of it. And also looking forward to having Jacob's well, though well, actually go out into this world in little pieces. I think that's going to be a really significant thing for us as a community. And even if you're worried, if I'm not really, you know, long-term part of this community, don't worry. There's stuff here to take. Take one of these smaller rocks if you want or something like that. And it'll help us vision for that day when we bring that well all back together and piece it all back together again and something to look forward to. So, today, you just watched a little clip of a guy ranting down in New York City on Wall Street, part of the Occupy Wall Street movement. And the reason I showed that for you is to help us, you know, kind of get into this understanding that there is stuff for all of us. There is stuff wrong. We look around us and we react and we think things aren't going the way they should. And that young man, as he was talking about fiscal policy here in the United States down on Wall Street, helped kind of frame the passion with which we really do feel these things. And he was articulating something deep within him and had an opportunity to do that. And now we're seeing, if you're watching the news and you're paying attention to what's going on, this is translating in all sorts of different places. And so it's interesting timing for us to be talking about these four revolutions. This is stuff that most of us, I believe, feel passionately about and yet don't necessarily have the opportunity to kind of articulate that. And more importantly, there are, because we're not articulating, because we're not talking about it, or we haven't been talking about it as regularly, we feel like maybe we're alone, or we're the only ones that feel this way. And this four-week series is actually intended to help us kind of realize that, no, you're not alone. And even more than not being alone is the fact that there's a whole God thing that thinks the same way that you do. That the Bible, as it tells a story about God and God's people and the relationship that God longs to have with us, really does support some of these revolutions that really that we see need to take place, and God agrees as well. And today we're going to talk about a really significant one, at least in my opinion, and it kind of has to do with what the young man on Wall Street was ranting about, but it's that sense that the people who make decisions that affect the rest of us have got it wrong, that they've lost touch, that they're not connected to us in ways that are powerful and they send us in the wrong direction, and that there really should be a better way to be the one who's in charge and to be the one who makes decisions, that there is a better way. You and I feel that, and God feels that too. The stories contained in the Bible talk about the relationship that God longs to have with us and God longs for us to have with each other. And if we take seriously these stories, they can help kind of shed some light on the way in which God has a different vision for how the world could operate. So today we're going to use one very particular story to kind of get us into this, get our mindsets in. In the Old Testament, there is a great collection of stories of the history of God's people as told in the Old Testament. And these stories oftentimes center around three very important sets of characters. The first are kings. So we're going to talk about king today. And the second are armies. And the third are prophets. And in this story that I want to tell you today, I want to talk about King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah was one of the kings of Judah, of Israel, of God's chosen people in Israel, and ancient Palestine. And Hezekiah followed a long succession of kings that sometimes kings were good, sometimes kings were very bad. In fact, often they were very bad. A bad king, as told in the stories of the Bible, were pretty obvious. They were the ones who were very self-interested and very concerned about their own skins. And they were concerned mostly about amassing wealth for themselves and building up their own power structure and their own power base. And they used their armies in order to do that. They often used their armies to kind of oppress the very people who they were called to rule, versus having their armies facing outward and protecting those people. The good kings, on the other hand, went the other direction. And Hezekiah was one of those good kings. Hezekiah, when we read the story in 2 Kings, Hezekiah's story is different. Hezekiah cared about his people. Hezekiah wanted to make sure his people were prosperous, that the agriculture was thriving, and that they were protected from the threats from the outside. Hezekiah's main concern was for his people. And that's the first of four lessons that we learn from Hezekiah. And so we've got kind of leadership lessons from an ancient king today, four of them very quickly. The first one Lesson number one, and this is on your outline if you want to follow along and you want to scribble it down just to keep track. But being in charge means looking out and keeping others' needs first. Good kings, as told in the Old Testament, are the ones who were concerned about everyone else, not themselves. The bad kings, self-interested all the way. So Hezekiah is ruling the people of Judah, and there is a very serious threat. This is the time when the Assyrian Empire rises up and becomes a very forceful empire in the Middle East, and starts to conquer neighboring lands. And eventually, as the Assyrians spread throughout the Middle East, of course, they come knocking on the door of Judah. Now, they had already conquered the neighboring northern kingdom of Israel. At this time, the kingdom had been split in two. The northern kingdom had already been conquered by the Assyrians. And it was bad news. The Assyrians were not good, nice people. I mean, when they conquered, they came in and they wiped people out. They hauled the leadership and whatever. If they didn't kill them, they hauled them away to another place. And they just oppressed the people. And things were not looking good for Judah as well. The capital of Judah, where Hezekiah was, is Jerusalem, where the temple was. And Hezekiah knew that this threat was coming and knew that he didn't have the capacity to control everything that was happening against this Assyrian threat. And eventually all he could do was knew that he could control the walls of the city of Jerusalem, and the rest of his kingdom would have to fall to the Assyrians. And that's what happened. But that leads us to lesson number two, is that Hezekiah knew what the limits of his control were. He didn't work outside of his capacity. He didn't work outside of the strength that he had. He knew what his limits were, and he rested upon those. And so they were able to keep Jerusalem secure, Hezekiah and his army. But sure enough, the Assyrian army marches right up to the walls of Jerusalem. And the Assyrian king sends his mighty general to come and essentially knock on the doors of Jerusalem. And Hezekiah puts together a small team of what he thinks are his best thinkers, his best military leaders, his chief of staff, his cabinet. And he sends him to negotiate with the Assyrian general. And they go out and they meet outside the walls of Jerusalem and they have a conversation of sorts. They try to negotiate some terms of surrender. Hezekiah's concern is for his people and the people of Jerusalem, and is certainly his concern for the temple. And he doesn't want bad things to happen. He doesn't want the place destroyed. He wants to negotiate some terms here. And the Assyrian general will have nothing to do with it. He is convinced that he is doing the right thing. The Assyrian general has been sent by the Assyrian king to just say, lay it down, we're coming in and we're taking over. And the Judeans try to negotiate, and they'll have nothing. In fact, the Assyrian general is so bold, he says, you know, look, we just wasted the neighborhood. The rest of your kingdom is toast. And the kingdom to the north, toast. And every kingdom that's ever come up against us, toast. So what makes you think you could stand up to us? And this God that you pray to, no match for us. Clearly, your God is nothing. And this is the message that the cabinet has to take back to Hezekiah. And Hezekiah hears this negotiation. Not really. And he doesn't know what to do. So he turns to the one person in his community, in his entourage, that speaks for God. And this is where the prophets come in. And the prophets in the Old Testament are people who speak for God and speak to God. Hezekiah knows that his only source of strength at this point is to turn to God and ask God for help. And you do that through the mediation of a prophet. So Hezekiah calls his prophet Isaiah. Now, the prophet Isaiah is responsible for writing lots big section of, in the Old Testament, and is and the stories of Isaiah are chronicled in other places. So Isaiah is a significant character. In fact, there are a number of people who actually carry the Isaiah name, a number of prophets. Hezekiah's prophet Isaiah comes and hears this story from Hezekiah, and he is asked, what should he do? And so Hezekiah goes and prays in the temple and asks God for direction. And Isaiah returns and tells Hezekiah that God is faithful, that you, Hezekiah, have been a good king, and God has shown you favor, and God will continue to show you favor if you continue to be a good king. It's a little bit cryptic, but that's kind of how prophets work, and that's kind of how the stories go. And so Hezekiah says, okay, I'll remain faithful and I'll trust. So he sends his generals, his cabinet, back out one more time to try and negotiate with the Assyrian general. Now, Hezekiah's cabinet, powerful people in the city of Jerusalem, certainly the upper crust of that society, and they begin, and they take a little different tact, because they realize, this is crazy. There is no way we're going to be able to stand up against this Assyrian army. They are much bigger. They're much more powerful. They have wiped out everything. You know, and maybe what this general is saying about our God that we pray to is true. And they begin to doubt. And when they doubt, they give us their next leadership lesson. They give us, they start to be worried not about the city of Jerusalem and not about the temple and not about all the people living there. They start to worry about themselves. And so they decide that when they go and negotiate with the Assyrian general, their primary concern is for themselves. And they're going to try and work out a side deal. They're going to try and work out a deal by which maybe they can escape and get out free. But this meeting that happens with the Assyrian general is on just outside the city walls. And all of Jerusalem is hanging on the edge of the walls, listening, wondering what's going to happen. And they can hear this story. And so when the Judean cabinet comes out to talk to the Assyrian general, they ask the Assyrian, would you let's not speak in Aramaic. Let's not speak in the language that all these people behind us could understand, because we have something else we want to talk to you about. Let's speak in a different language. And the Assyrian general just says, and he goes on and he tells again how powerful this Assyrian army is and how much they're just going to walk in and take over the place, and you might as well just give up now because your God doesn't mean anything. And he says it in perfect Aramaic so everybody on the wall can hear. So that's our third lesson for today from this ancient king and these ancient stories, is that you got to keep the important stuff out in the open. Because you imagine what the people of Jerusalem, how they would have responded if they'd heard, and as they heard, these attempted secret negotiations. Reminiscent of stuff that goes on in our life today? Absolutely. Well, the cabinet returns dejected back to Hezekiah. Hezekiah is faced with this again. What should I do? He turns to his prophet one more time and he asks Isaiah, what should we do? And Isaiah returns right away and just says, you need to pray to God. And so Hezekiah turns and takes something he never did. And he himself goes into the temple and gets down on his knees and he prays. And he prays for deliverance. He prays for help. He prays for strength in the face of uncertainty. Our fourth lesson today is if you're going to rule with integrity, you have to be willing. You don't ask anyone to do something you're not willing to do yourself. Plain and simple, when Hezekiah puts himself in the temple, prays to God, and asks for deliverance, the Lord looks upon Hezekiah with favor and delivers. And the next morning, we're not exactly sure how it happened, but the Assyrian army is wiped out, and the remnant return to Assyria. And the king that sent that army to Jerusalem dies very soon thereafter. And Hezekiah's, and Jerusalem is saved, and the countryside is saved, and Hezekiah's rule continues. It's a great story from the Old Testament. It gives us some sense of a different way that we could be in charge, a different way that we could run. In Isaiah, in the book of Isaiah, and you have on the back of your handout there, this little section from the 63rd chapter of Isaiah. And I'm just going to read this aloud because it gives us a sense of how we respond when we trust God and God's vision for how we should be in relationship with each other, and how those of us, when we're put in positions of authority, how we should act. "I will recount the gracious deeds of the Lord," says Isaiah, "the praiseworthy acts of the Lord. Because of all that the Lord has done for us, and the great favor to the house of Israel that he has shown them according to his mercy, and according to the abundance of his steadfast love." Hezekiah's rule of his people and his care and concern for his people was in response to God's mercy and his love. He looked at a God that loved him, and this is how he responded and how he led his people, through mercy and through love. Well, this is just one of many kings talked about in the Bible, in the Old Testament. And much of these king stories also set the stage and foreshadow for what is to come. And who's to come? And in a couple of months here, we're going to celebrate that coming of the next king in the form of a tiny infant baby born in a stable in a backwater town, in a backwater place in Palestine. And the story that comes out of Jesus's leadership and Jesus's kingship sets the stage for us today. So now let's take a look at Jesus for a moment and the kind of vision that Jesus sets for those of us who are in power and those of us who have opportunity to lead and those of us who are in relationship with people in power. Jesus sets a very different, albeit strange, perspective on leadership. And in the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus is telling lots of things, there's one great section in Matthew that's chronicled in Matthew that we'll read together now and listen for Jesus' take on what it means to be in relationship, especially relationships of power. "If someone takes unfair advantage of you, use the occasion to practice the servant life. No more tit-for-tat stuff. Live generously. You're familiar with the old written law, love your friend and its unwritten companion, hate your enemy. Well, I'm here to challenge that. I'm telling you to love your enemies. Let them bring out the best in you, not the worst. When someone gives you a hard time, respond with the energy of prayer. For then you are working out of your true selves, your God-created selves. This is what God does. He gives his best, the sun to warm and the rain to nourish, to everyone, regardless. The good and the bad, the nice and the nasty. If all you do is love the lovable, do you expect a bonus? Anyone can do that. If you simply say hello to those who greet you, do you expect a medal? Any run-of-the-mill sinner can do that. In a word, what I'm saying is, grow up. You're kingdom subjects. Now live like it. Live out your God-created identity. Live generously and graciously towards others, the way that God lives toward you. Now that translation comes from Eugene Peterson in The Message, and he kind of puts it in some contemporary language, but I think it's helpful for us to hear Jesus talking to us right now, saying, yeah, there's a different way that we have to act. And the way that we, God-created people, have somehow conspired together to mess it up isn't the right way. And God and Jesus is painting a different vision for us, one that doesn't rely on the strength of armies and the strength of position and the strength of money in your pocket and the strength of the influence of your friends. Jesus paints a very different picture for us. And he suggests there's four powerful acts that we could do. And I would say these four powerful acts could change the world. So let's unpack these really quick. First, first powerful act that can change the world, generosity. Generosity. If you operate in such a way that when you face the world, you take your position from a sense of generosity, what do you have to offer? What can you give? Versus what does the world owe me? What do you owe me? What can you give me? Doesn't get you anywhere. Turn it around. What do I have to offer you? As soon as we take that tact, we could change the world. Quick story. Some of you were around a year ago, a little more than a year ago, when we did the Just Start series, and we got to meet a young man, a remarkable young man by the name of Alex Flegel, who lives here in the Twin Cities. And he was handed in church one day a $100 bill, along with a bunch of other people who got handed a $100 bill, and they said, here's $100. Go make a difference in the world. Go bring a little bit of this kingdom that we hear about Jesus talking about all the time. Make that real. Spend this $100. So in this generous act, Alex took this $100 that he had no idea was coming his way, and he spent a lot of time thinking and researching, and what could he do? And he discovered something really interesting about malaria and how malaria was affecting people in Africa. And he discovered that the best way to fight malaria was plain and simple to put up a mosquito net at night in your home to keep the mosquitoes away from your bed, because that's when they bit. They were always at night. And all you had to do was put up an insecticide-treated mosquito net, and you'd be safe, and you'd cut down the instances of malaria. Amazing. One net cost $10. $100? 10 nets. Alex thought, this is where I'm going to invest this $100 that was given to me, and I'm going to be generous, and I'm going to put it back into the world, and I'm going to help 10 families. But that wasn't enough for Alex. He decided that he could do better than 10 nets. And so he started pestering and bugging and asking and telling this story about these mosquito nets to everybody, including this community. And last told, I think Alex has raised something in the neighborhood of $4,000. 400 nets. 400 families in Africa have been affected because Alex, a little 10-year-old here in Roseville, thought he could do something different. He could take the generosity that had been shown him and turn that back out. Generosity, when you think about what you could do for somebody else. Second powerful act, sacrifice. Again, what could I do for you? And sacrifice is a little bit more than generosity. It's actually, I'm willing to give you everything. I'm willing to give you everything, even if it means my life. Now, we celebrated Veterans Day Friday, and I'm sure you all have people in your lives, and great example of veterans' willingness to sacrifice, to give it everything they have, their very selves. Lots of stories of sacrifice in our lives. I want to tell you a quick story about a professor of mine at the seminary. His name's Dirk Lang. Before the wall came down in Berlin, before the Iron Curtain fell in Eastern Europe, Dirk was a part of the Taizé community in France, and they would get sent out on peaceful missions into Eastern Europe. That was the public story. The private story was that they would gather clandestine groups to pray that wall would come down. And every time they did that, every time Dirk gathered a group of people together to pray about that, he was breaking the law and he was risking his own life. Sacrifice. Well, we know how the story goes. We know the wall came down. And I'm certainly one to think, I sure hope it was because of that prayer. All those people gathered clandestinely together at night, and he's got great stories to tell about that. But everyone risked their safety, their security, their comfort, their lives to do that, to change the world. Third act that can change the world, forgiveness. Boy, it is easy to hold a grudge in this world. I get wronged all the time. And it's really easy to see it and to feel it. But it's really hard to forgive someone. to say, it doesn't matter. Face the world with forgiveness in your heart, and you can change the world. You probably remember a few years ago, a crazy lunatic walked into a country schoolhouse in Pennsylvania and shot the place up and killed a bunch of students and a teacher. This was in the Amish community of Dutch Pennsylvania, and a very powerful, powerful thing happened. Almost immediately, the very first public statement that that community, who were absolutely grieving the loss of their young ones, the very first thing that they said was, we forgive him, the shooter who did this. Because we cannot face the world unless we do that. That this world doesn't make any sense to us if we don't first forgive him for what he's done. That's a powerful story. It's a powerful story of the power of forgiveness. Now, I know that story touched me, and that certainly touched lots of folks. The power of forgiveness. The fourth act, and probably the greatest one of them all, and we heard Jesus talk about it. The fourth act that will change the world, love. Plain and simple, love. When we turn and we face the world and those that we need to be in relationship, those that God has called us to be together with, to support and care for each other, if we do that with a sense of love, the same love that God has shown us, then we can really change the world. There was a nun in Haiti. Her name is Gertrude. There's a picture of her. Gertrude runs the orphanage that we went down to go see last year down in Haiti. And she loves her country. She loves these children that she's collected in her home. So much so that she decided she didn't need to be a nun anymore. She just needed to run this orphanage. And for special needs children. And then a few years ago, there was some massive flooding. This is before the earthquake. There was some massive flooding in the neighborhood. And all of the neighbors came onto her property where she has the orphanage because they knew Gertrude could provide some help for them. And then they gave her their children. So she has this massive collection of children. And every day, when she looks at those kids, all she sees is love. She's changing the world. In Haiti, of all places, with nothing besides love. That's how the world's going to change. When we stop thinking that the people who are in power and the people who are decision-making, that we have no control over that, that we have no say in that, we're wrong. We can stand on a street corner, and we can shout, and we can yell, but let's think about what we could change, and how we could change the world. Jesus sets out a story. Hezekiah laid the groundwork. Face the world differently, people. Face the world differently, Jacob's Well, this week. Go at it with generosity. What do you have to offer? What could you sacrifice? How could you love? Who do you need to forgive to move forward? This is the story that God's called us into. So this week, Jacob's Well, let's take our hunk of well, let's walk out from here, and let's face this world, and let's say that things aren't good enough, and things could be better, and ask God to be with us, and guide us, and continue to lead us, and greet each other, and greet those in our family, and come at them with this new perspective, one that comes from a generous place and a sacrificial place and a forgiving place, and most importantly, from a loving place. That's my prayer for us today, Jacob's Well, and my charge to you that we go and do. Amen.